Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, Paco, so what's the first punk show you ever saw?
I think it was Firehose.
Great band.
What about you?
I think in high school, I saw the band that turned into Hickey. They were called the Fuck Boys.
Oh, nice.
So if you hear people talking about Fuck Boys, we were there first. Hey, I'm George Chen.
And I'm Pac Romain.
And welcome to SupDoc.
And on this show, we ask musicians, comedians, filmmakers, and other creative people to handpick a favorite documentary.
And today, we're going to be discussing The Decline of Western Civilization. This is Penelope Spheris's 1980 chronicle of the Los Angeles punk underground, one of the most important music documentaries by the director of Wayne's World.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of footage here of a lot of the Slash Records bands, including Black Flag, X, the Circle Jerks, Catholic Discipline, and The Germs, of course, Darby Crash and The Germs. And this movie just got its first DVD issue, all three Decline movies, and then there's a whole other disc of extras included.
It's great. And our guest for today is technology writer and podcaster and punk music lover, Peter Rojas. Just see what's going on, dude.
So, welcome to the house, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and
I feel like I kind of bullied my way onto the show.
No, I wanted you to do it, too. Like, I think we had talked about it. You listened to the Sam McPheeters one,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I enjoyed.
Yeah, honestly. I thought it was a good one.
Did you wrestle George to get on the show?
Well, I feel like maybe I guilted him a little bit.
Okay.
I put some pressure on.
Yeah.
No, I'm happy to have you on. You've been doing podcasts for longer than any of us.
Yeah, since I think 2005, so about 10 years.
What's that show called?
So the first one I did was the Engadget podcast, which I started a site called Engadget, and we did a podcast. It was actually one of the very first podcasts that came out. Which I actually wasn't the original host of the Engadget podcast. It was actually some other people, and then they left.
Then you bullied your way onto that podcast.
I bullied my way onto that show.
Just being bossy, literal boss.
Exactly. And then what had happened was they left, and the show needed a host, and I said, there's no way I can find time to do this. And then I started doing it and I really loved it.
Oh, yeah.
So like, this is part of my job.
Yeah, but I realized, well, I probably should pick up the slack. And then I did that for a few years, then did a podcast for another site I started just called Gadget. And then now I do a show called MVP with my friend Ryan, who I'd worked with for a really long time.
Are they review shows or?
It's more like a conversational show about technology, like what we think is interesting in tech, but this latest one is just about products. So we won't talk about news or anything like that.
It'll just
be like what kind of stuff we think is worth talking about.
So. And you just moved back to San Francisco after being in New York forever.
Yeah. I was in New York. I was in New York for about 14 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And Ryan lives here. So you guys do your podcast in person.
Yeah, we do it in person. Though we don't have a producer, which I think is maybe we need to up our game a little bit.
I don't know if you want to steal ours. We're trying to hold on to him. But So why did you choose Decline of Western Civilization?
So it was one of those, when I got into punk and hardcore, which I guess would have been late 80s, early 90s, this is one of those things that was hard to find, but people talked about. It was a documentary that people talked about, and sort of, it's funny how even in 88, 89, and this thing was made and shot in like 79 and 80, I think released in 81. And, it seemed like ancient history even at the time. It seemed so far back, like this kind of classic thing that this, I wouldn't say golden era, because when you watch the documentary, it's clear that like people were mainly seemed kind of miserable.
Yes.
But it was the sort of thing like that was when it was real. Right. Mm-hmm.
And it was only like, you're right, like 8, 9 years after the fact.
Yeah, it only been a few years earlier, really. I mean, when you're young, when you're a teenager, everything seems really long, a really long time ago. But I just remember watching it. I must have been either senior year of high school or maybe freshman year of college. And you'd watch it and you're just like, wow, this is the real shit. Like, this is like these guys, like this was the crazy real hardcore
this
scene.
This was the scene. Did you grow up in LA?
I grew up in the San Joaquin Valley in Merced.
Okay.
So I grew up in California, but there's no punk scene where I grew up at all. Really.
In Merced.
In Merced.
And did you ever do a teenage thing where you got into a friend's van and took off to some faraway city to see a punk band?
I did when I was in college, yeah. I was friends with... we do that where you're friends with a band, and then they have like a show in New York. I went to college in the East Coast, and we drive to New York.
Was the band that you were told to hang out with?
A band called Coleman.
Coleman. Oh, yeah.
Do you remember them?
I remember the name. Yeah.
They never really got out that much.
They
outside.
Had that one four-band, 7-inch with like Fisticuffs Bluff, I remember.
No, that was
Coleman?
I don't think that was Coleman.
Okay.
They did a split 12-inch with Three Studies for a Crucifixion.
Okay, yeah.
That's where you might know them from.
Yeah.
And
this is getting pretty deep. Yeah, for our casual listeners,
we're getting a little in the weeds.
That's
for
fine,
for our listeners
going.
Who don't know what decline of Western civilization.
But anyway,
is.
So like these guys would go. I jump in the van with them, and we drive down to New York mm-hmm. from Boston, and they'd play at ABC No Rio.
Which
is still. I mean, it's still around, actually.
Is it? I thought it was gone.
No, it's still around. I actually,
same location.
Lived a few blocks from it. Now it's a landmark almost.
What?
Like the city is now. Giving them money to renovate it and do all this stuff with it. But at the time, it was a squat, anarchist squat.
Yeah.
you play shows in the basement. I think they play with Los Crudos.
And this is like 90.
This would have been 96. 96? Maybe.
Okay.
So 95. 95.
Yeah. And Coleman was a Boston band?
Yeah, they were both from Boston.
Yeah, I didn't know that much about them. But we're about the same age and same era. And like, I remember seeing. This and Suburbia in high school. So I think it was available on VHS for a while.
Yeah.
But like this right now, it just came out on DVD. So the timing is also good. It came out on DVD, an entire box set with Decline of Western Civilization 2 and
the
3
collection.
Also. And some extra footage. It's got like extra interviews. Like it has the entire Darby Crash kitchen interview. It's like 16 minutes long. I didn't get around to it. But there's good commentary. There's commentary with Penelope Spheeris and there's commentary with Dave Grohl. Didn't listen to Dave Grohl.
care what he has to say.
No, he's interesting because like obviously he's...
Well, he came out of the hardcore scene.
Right, and Pat Smear is in the Foo Fighters too, so that makes sense as another connection. But I remember seeing this and it was like less than a decade away from the other one. It's interesting, we did a episode on Bones Brigade, and I also think that is very like early 80s,
kind of
like
a seminal
punk
video.
Culture.
Very California.
Yeah.
It's just that things change. I think that aesthetically things change so much between 1980 and 1990.
Yeah.
And Jeez, by the same true. Token, I think aesthetically not that much changed between 1990 and 2000, maybe, or 2020. It's like that kind of, have you seen this theory that like the rate of like aesthetic change in our culture has actually slowed down?
Oh, no,
because if you would take like the average pop hit from 20 years ago and play it on the radio today, it actually, most people might not notice that being that much different, or maybe 15 years ago.
Right.
But if you took the average pop song from, say, 1975 and played it on the radio in 1990, people would be like, what the hell? Yeah. What's going on?
Right.
Yeah. Or did I tune into the oldie station? Or same thing with, like, say, 1960 and 1975, like the gap aesthetically in the culture between
That's
1960 and 1970 or 1970 and 1980, there were huge changes.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we see that same... magnitude of kind of cultural shift anymore.
Right. I remember hearing someone, I heard a similar idea of that, which was like a couple of years ago, like the time between when punk happened, if you say punk happened in 76 and then like rap happened in like 80 or 79, 80, then like there hasn't been another major thing in the last like 35 years.
Genre.
Arguably. I don't know. I mean, there's obviously tons of subjects.
Electronic music kind of.
Yeah, yeah. That could be it. But like it doesn't have all the... I don't think it has the same cultural impact the way like hip-hop or punk did. Or maybe that's just a personal bias because that's my generation.
Well, I think what's
bias.
Happened is that a lot of the way that I hate to say young people because like, when you're old, like what do you say, right?
Yeah, youngins.
Millennials.
Which I hate. Yeah, I hate
every episode we just make fun of that. But
I think why I think this documentary is so interesting is because we don't really have subcultures around music. We don't really have subcultures in even the traditional sense that we did pre-internet, because the idea of a subculture was that you had sort of a mainstream media culture and then you had these literally kind of undercultures that came up in opposition to that.
Mm-hmm.
And now the internet is so, I don't want to say it's flattened everything out so much, but it's made everything
it's
equally accessible.
Yeah.
That the idea that you would have that you would define yourselves in terms of, define yourself in terms of the culture you consume when it's equally accessible to everybody else is really hard. Like what one thing that made punk so powerful is that a lot of the, I mean, you know, a lot of the signifiers, so to speak, like weren't accessible to everybody. Like you had to either like know somebody who turned you, like think
older
about
brother.
Like how mixtapes and things like that, like, or going to the right, having the right record store where you could go and like ask somebody what to listen, you know, what to buy or like,
it was word of mouth, man. Yeah. A lot of that stuff was. But also, I feel like there was a time when there was two camps. There was like, we're talking about accessibility and like the radio. There was mainstream FM radio, and then there was college radio.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you could get turned on to really cool music by listening to college radio. And then sometime in the mid-90s, alternative radio like swallowed up college radio, where they're like, we're going to take your format because you're cool, and all of a sudden things kind of like diffused a bit,
right? Like your K-Rocks and your and your Live 105s, where like it be, and those play the same songs they did 30 years ago now. They just play The Cure and like, and they'll play some modern stuff, and it's interesting, some rap gets into those stations, but it's very
well, it was all like everything ended with an X, so 91X alternative radio.
I think they were all, it was all one, either one clear channel thing where they were branding it all across. Cause if you notice like all the classic rock stations are like the Eagle, the Bone, like they all have like a kind of an animal kind of, like and, the bear.
And right,
like 92.3, the bear.
91X was San Diego. So then maybe the rest of those.
Wait, I think was 91X the one that was actually in Mexico and it was so.
Oh, maybe it was because San Diego could have crossed the border.
Yeah, because it was one of those things where like they're like, fuck your FCC or we're in Mexico and we can just broadcast as powerfully as we want.
I just remember hearing about 91X and it's like taking over the college format. Like they're doing alternative stuff where you could hear REM and The Replacements and stuff like that on an actual FM radio.
Well, Pete, you also did college radio.
I did college radio,
That's kind of a legendary, like, is it the show is Record Hospital? Or
It's, the show's called Record Hospital. The station was WHRB, which had this weird...
Where
it was in Boston, in Cambridge, and they had did jazz in the morning, classical in the afternoon and the evening, and then rock was relegated to like the air
like
hours
midnight,
of like 10 to
graveyard
like 4
shifts,
but no one wanted to actually be on. But it was a pretty legendary kind of legendary station in the college scene. Like they were, I think, the first radio station to play, REM, first radio station to play Husker Du. I mean, they definitely were, had this sort of thing where super anti-corporate, like no major label music. And I remember really pissing off, like you get these label like PR people who would, marketing people who'd call you up and they're like, why aren't you playing? Like,
because were you the music director?
I was the music director.
That's like, that's can be a job where you play ball and try to get yourself a record industry job, or you can just be like, no, I'm just gonna go rogue.
No, mainly what I would do is I would tell them that we were playing I would tell them we love their record. Could you send a bunch of promo copies for the DJ so they could listen to them also at home? And then we take all those copies, sell them, and then buy like Honeywell records or something like that.
Right.
Sell them to like, what's the chain out there? Newberry's?
Newberry Comics didn't buy used stuff, but there was In Your Ear, and I used to work at In Your Ear Records.
Oh, and Twisted Village was Boston?
Twisted Village was there,
They're gone, right?
They must be at this point.
Totally
it's hard
gone,
to imagine that surviving.
Yeah, there's nothing like college radio. I was
still
GM
around
for a while as well. Yeah, college radio is definitely still around. But there was a time in the 90s, I think, when college radio was really the tastemaker of like, you know, alternative music and stuff you're just never going
to
hear.
I was even thinking about like how, to me, podcasts are very, they're similar to blog culture, but they're really similar to zine culture in a way. That's, to me, even more so than blog culture. Or maybe it's just because I'm doing a podcast and I did a zine, so I think I see the through line.
Well, the funny thing is how much, if you grew up in the zine culture in the 90s, how much... how sort of at home you felt on the internet when you're like, oh, like people arguing over like arcane nonsense. Like I'm familiar with that, right? People pissed off each other over like really petty grievances. I remember like the zine stuff would be like, you didn't mention, you like, you dissed me in your zine, you know? And it's like, and you'd be like, you know, one of those things where like zines were so smallly circulated that you'd be like, oh yeah, like I did that like 10 months ago or something like that.
Right.
Nothing happened in real time.
It's a major accomplishment that we come out every month because there are a lot of problems tugging at the whole thing every month. I mean, it seems like each month we seem to alienate at least one record company by a review or a band or someone, you know, that's pissed off at us.
Wild God! No pressure, come
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I feel like we should try to, we should sum up this doc for people who haven't, because right. I know it's kind of hard to find. So do you want to,
well, yeah,
George, you want to sum it up?
Well, we can get back to, yeah, Decline of Western Civilization. It's not called Decline of Western Civilization 1. It just was the first one. There happened to be two more in the series directed by Penelope Spheeris. She was in Los Angeles. It seems like the first one seems like kind of a big love letter to X, because they're kind of, I think, the band that she focuses on the most. But she just starts following around bands that were playing at The Mask. So the bands, there's live footage, there's some interview footage. There's a lot of backstage, or not backstage, just like home footage of her interviewing Darby Crash at home and X at their house, and they're giving each other stick and poke tattoos. They go to the church where Black Flag is living, which I thought that was, I thought they were in Long Beach when they started, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Greg Ginn's just from Long Beach.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, but there was like interviews and live performances. And not everyone gets interviewed. Like, there was no interview with Keith Morris. There was no interview with Alice Bagg.
Yeah.
But the bands that are featured are considered, like, mostly, like, I think there's a couple bands that I think could have been included
yeah.
that she left out.
The Weirdos.
Say, like, Nervous Gender, which has a lot of members that are also in Catholic Discipline
yeah.
and in the Bags. I think there's a lot of overlap there. But and the Screamers, yeah. But it is a good survey of that scene, and it was kind of the only someone with a professional camera shooting those bands at the time. Two cameras a lot for the live footage, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe three cameras. I think at least two.
Yeah, definitely. I've seen some still photos, and it looks like they have a couple camera guys
yeah.
like near the stage. And
yeah. I was 79, 80, and she also goes to talk to the people that run Slash Magazine. And the guys that are running the venues, like there's Club 88, and then Brendan.
I love
Mullen
the Club 88 guy.
Yeah, because he's so like chill. He's a lot older, like I'd say 60s, 70s.
Yeah.
And but he's just like, well, they just need a release valve.
They just need a release of their energy.
I've tried all kinds of dancing.
Yeah,
this pogo dance doesn't seem that crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like what it sounds like.
I remember doing that dance at like my grandma and grandpa's 50th wedding anniversary.
Doing
and,
the pogo.
Yeah, and it was just him and I dancing to like polka or something, yeah. and doing. And I remember all my relatives were just like, "What the fuck are you guys doing? What is that
is this because your brother was into punk?
Yeah, probably. I don't remember. I just remember doing it and everyone thinking we were odd.
And now, Paco, this is your both Pete and I have seen this at least, you know, before in our lives. This is your first time watching mm-hmm. this film. What was your impression of it?
Well, I thought it was good. I was like, there's no real storyline. I kind of missed, like, I didn't feel like there was much of an arc to it. Mm-hmm. I was kind of looking for an arc. I mean, obviously, you have to put it in, like, context of the year that it was made. And I don't know how old Penelope was when she made it. Like,
see, this is like a 35th anniversary. So she's like 70 now. She's probably early 30s.
Early yeah, 30s. Yeah. I didn't have any real connection to the people she was talking to because I didn't grow up listening to punk music. My brother, on the other hand, was a huge punk fan. He had Fear t-shirts and, you know, all that kind of mm-hmm. stuff. And I remember my dad was always like, why are you wearing those t-shirts? And so I asked him about it. Yeah. I was like, there's anything you remember? And he just remembers saying, like, when people heard that it'd come out, like, everybody was trying to find it.
The documentary.
The documentary. Yeah. And yep. you could not, because I grew up.
Oh, back in the 80s.
In the
80s. Knew about
yeah.
Because, yeah, it screened once in Los Angeles. And the chief of police is like, wrote them like, you cannot screen
that's
this in LA again.
That's an
yeah.
incredible story.
Well, that's the whole thing with like the police and Black Flag had this whole like rivalry thing going on.
I mean, it's crazy to see the police so upset about stuff white kids
Yeah.
Like, that's something that we forget that, like,
yeah.
Like, they don't, like, I don't think they would be upset about, like, bunch of white kids getting together.
Yeah. No.
And slam dancing.
That tells you about that time. People were scared of punk music.
Oh, yeah. And, like, it's funny. Like, I just did a thing. Jeremy Wheat has a show at Lost Weekend where we riff on TV shows. And he showed both the Chips Punk episode and the Quincy Punk episode.
That's where Quincy Punks was a derogatory term.
You're right. Yeah.
No
like,
way.
Like some, if you called someone a Quincy Punk, it was because on Quincy, they
Quincy
kind of got,
M.E.
They, yeah. Yeah. Like, they, it was like, let's Jack go Coleman and get like punks from central casting, like kind of thing. And so you would call someone a Quincy Punk to be like,
They're
you're
fake.
Like a TV punk, like a fake punk.
A poser.
Yeah. And like, it's definitely like based on, it looks like they're trying to do Fear, or like Fear is like the band in Chips. I forget the name of the band, but it's totally based
it's
on
scared.
Fear. Like, yeah, I think they're called like Rage or something like that. And like, it's the singer is obviously, it's based on like that, like they probably saw like, just berating people and then just a bass player hitting someone in the audience with their bass.
Right, right.
And then the band that is on the Quincy episode is a little bit artsier and like a little bit more like tribal makeup-y. There's also, yeah, it's interesting because it would be totally scary. I mean, I think I was kind of frightened of this when I first saw it. And I also used to be kind of frightened of just even like seeing, because I was interested in underground music, but the early punk stuff, like the kind of hardcore stuff, I was just like, I feel like it's racist, even though I can't like put my finger on it. Well, I can put my finger on some of it. There's definitely some like swastikas and things, but it really took me a while to kind of adjust to the being involved in the punk scene and just kind of realizing what a white space it was, and like not really having a way to think about
very
it at
male.
The time. Very well, yeah. There were a lot of women around, and there was a lot of people. There were people of color around in Berkeley, at least when I was going. But when I think of it as a phenomenon, when you look at this, you think it's almost totally white people. There's like Ron Reyes, who is a singer of Black Flag. At that time, he just replaced Keith Morris as a singer of Black Flag. But, you know, that was something that was kind of off-putting about it, but also kind of intriguing and a little bit scary about it. I
remember my brother was telling me the thing that he loved most is like seeing Fear and X and realizing that you can play punk and be good. A good musician at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, that was his thing. He was like, well, you can do both. That's amazing.
I think X was like one of the first bands I saw or got into that was from the punk scene. But when you put them in context with everyone else, they are the most traditional rock and roll in a certain way.
Yeah.
Some of their song structures are really interesting. Like, I still kind of don't really understand. Like, We're Desperate is kind of like three jagged parts that don't really fit together, like and some of that, like whatever the first song they have in there is like really almost like krautrock and how repetitive it is. But X was one of the first bands I liked in punk, and but they're still more of a rock and roll band in the end, I think.
The thing I thought was so interesting, and I think your point about it being there's not a narrative. I think she was just trying to document what was going on. And it's interesting that she, you know, showed not just one full, let them play one full track, that they have multiple songs in full, which sometimes you watch a music documentary and it's like, just let me watch the whole song.
Yeah.
Right? Like, don't show me like 30 seconds or 40 seconds. So I kind of appreciated that. But what I thought was really fascinating about what she was capturing was this transition from sort of the earlier punk scene into the hardcore scene. And I mean, if you look at like what people think of as being the LA hardcore scene, it's not necessarily, I mean, you certainly wouldn't put the Germs in that camp or X. You might put Fear, and you put Black Flag. But like 1980, 79, 80 was like, things had kind of moved away from the real, like kind of Anglophile British inspired, punk scene, which was in a way, it was more diverse in terms of, not just in terms of it being more gender balanced, but also accommodating like a larger variety of kind of musical styles and approaches to the music. And then things became a lot more codified, I think, post sort of Black Flag becoming really popular. And then all these bands, like one of the things that I was reading about, because there's an oral, like Vice posted an oral history of Decline, a few months ago, which I read. And there was a sort of like tension between the people from Hollywood and then like the people from the beach. Right. And they were like, we don't want these people from like Huntington Beach and like Long Beach and like the beach guys coming, because and the scene became more kind of male, more like more aggressive and more violent after that, and kind of pushed out. If you were kind of like, if you were attracted to punk because you were like gay or like weird or whatever.
Like a Hollywood person.
Yeah, like it was a more accepting kind of place. Like you kind of got pushed out once the scene became more about hardcore.
It was just interesting to me because you were in Boston. Like my impression of like the 80s Boston hardcore scene is it's a real meathead and real
male. I mean, that's the thing that happened about hardcore is that by the late 80s, the most popular bands were these like kind of really aggressive youth crew style bands, like a lot of them coming out of New York. And I didn't connect with any of that stuff at all. I mean, that stuff like didn't, I mean, you know, I could listen to some of it, but I wasn't like, this it didn't resonate with me. If anything, like the thread that kind of kept hardcore going for me in the late 80s would be like the DC Discord Fugazi stuff. And then when it reemerged, when hardcore kind of reemerged or I don't know, say like flowered in the 90s, the bands that like I was excited about were not, you know, it's almost like they kind of skipped the stuff that was going on in the late 80s and would either go back to like the early 80s stuff, or they would, you know, take that sound and merge it with something else.
I think it's interesting what you're saying about like the sort of the Anglophile angle on some of those bands. Like it definitely comes off in like when Catholic Discipline's playing, I feel like it's like the least, it's the most like new wave sounding of all the bands in there. And it's like led by this French dude. But it is, maybe it's the fact that there's keyboards, but it's just like, it's more about being arty than being full. And so, yeah, that dynamic you're saying, there's like a dynamic of the bands that were, I guess, Black Flag and Circle Jerks, probably the most representative in this movie.
And the stuff that kind of came after that was, I mean, if you look at, say, like Bad Religion or, or a lot, I mean, a lot of those things were not being kind of sensitive or weird or not really tough. That was not like, that was, you know, you kind of got pushed out of that scene. It certainly like got so violent that you wouldn't really want to be around that.
Right. And then Straight Edge came in kind of right.
Well, Straight Edge came out of DC. So that, it was early 80s. That was like Minor Threat and a lot of the DC stuff. And that's when, I mean, hardcore also in some ways was a lot more political than punk. I mean, we think of punk as being this sort of political protest kind of music, but not as much, overtly. I mean, some of it in England a little bit. But I think that hardcore was sort of more overtly political, and political in the sense that they're having a strong point of view is like, what's the right way to go about things, that there's a right way to do things and a wrong way to do things.
You mean like and you're talking about music or talking about the ethics
both
of
musically
running your band?
And both in terms of the ethics of how you operate as a business, or as a band, and also in terms of the way that the music should be. And I think that punk was definitely more nihilistic. And so punk was more like, whatever the fuck you want, right? Like, I should get to do whatever I want, like, kind of, like, fuck the world, nihilistic kind of thing. And hardcore was more, well, there's a right way and there's a wrong way, right? And like, this is what we're opposed to, and we don't want... It's like when Maximum Rock and Roll decided that they weren't going to review...
Major labels or barcodes.
But they also weren't going to review music that didn't sound punk according to their definition of punk.
Right, yeah.
And that's actually a more hardcore... So there's always been this tension, I think, between, and, you know, we kind of see a lot of that tension today when you see all this stuff on like college campuses around like political correctness versus like, you know, should you, you know, do you have the right to be offensive and, you know, stuff like that.
I like what you're saying about like the nihilism, because that really struck me, because I guess because the scene in punk that I came up through was like this Berkeley scene. So it was more of that sort of, there was a lot of rigidity and a lot of like sort of, unspoken codes you're supposed to learn. Whereas you look at like the Germs and early punk and even a lot of British punk, it is that negation idea. It's like working class anger and like it just goes towards what you were saying earlier about creating an identity that's in opposition to a mainstream. I think that's a lot of what it like punk was a reactionary movement. And then maybe hardcore
grew out of punk, and it grew out of a lot of people feeling like punk kind of failed, right? That punk was supposed to be this big thing. And then it's funny when we think about Sex Pistols coming in 76 and then by 79, I mean, people were like, punk's dead, right? It's completely run out of steam in 3 years.
Yeah.
And then in the UK, you saw bands like Crass kind of coming up, and Crass in a way are hard. I mean, they sound maybe more punk, but they're, politics were very hardcore in the sense it's like we're anarchist collectivists, anti-statist, and if you are part of that system, if you are part of the capitalist system, like, we don't have anything to do with you.
And they were like, also, there was so much more to them than music. Yep. There was like a lot of the visual aesthetics of it, and just like the posters were very confrontational. I guess I would also say, like, you know, like Dead Kennedys being one of the more political bands, yep, out of the West Coast,
yeah,
punk scene, you know, and that's there in a kind of a contrast to Black Flag, I, yeah, would say. Because Black Flag is known for like kind of helping create the infrastructure of punk.
Yeah.
But like they're not a political band.
They weren't a political band. I mean, I think the stuff they did around DIY was really,
yeah, important. That's like where they came, yeah, in.
And I think that was one of the things credit that kind of blew my mind when I got into punk and hardcore, which was this idea that you didn't have to, that you could just put out a record or just be in a band and just do stuff. And, you know, when you're like 12 or 13, you start really, you know, when I started getting music, like when I was 12 or 13, you kind of the only music world you know of is kind of like, well, it comes on, it's on MTV, mm-hmm, and like, it's all, you don't even know what a major label is. You're just like, it's just this big corporate like music machine. And you're like, how can I become a part of that? Right. Cause, yeah, you want to be a rock star. And then you realize, like, well, there's this whole world outside of that that you can just be a part of on your own terms. And I think that was one of the things that, not to talk about another documentary, but like in the Minutemen documentary,
oh, yeah,
where Mike Watt talks about, like, when we discovered that we could put out a record on our own, it was like, you didn't think that was like a thing that people could do.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be like the equivalent of just being like, oh, just like go and be on TV, go do a TV show. And, right, it's like, mm-hmm, you know, in the 80s, like that was, do you remember when we were growing up, like the idea that you could be on TV would be like the biggest thing that could ever happen,
yeah,
to you?
Yeah. It seemed unfathomable. I was like, I think you have to grow up in Hollywood to be on TV.
Yeah. Like, I remember being like, I remember you'd always be like, if you knew somebody who knew someone who had been on TV, if you knew somebody who had been on TV, like that, yeah, was like the biggest thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was like some child actor at my school that had a role on like Full House or something. I was never like a lot younger than me. I don't remember. But I remember being like the only time I was on TV when I was a kid was I answered phones at a public television telethon.
Nice.
I was like KTEH, like the sci-fi channel. So it's like, my friends that would watch Doctor Who would have seen, or Red Dwarf would have seen me on, like, that's right, cool, after that.
So did you know about, were you interested in punk before you saw this documentary, or was this documentary your like gateway into?
No, I already knew about it and was listening to punk, but I mean, you kind of, it's funny like how inaccessible just information was. And so,
yeah,
kind of, you know, I knew Black Flag, knew a little bit about the Germs, knew the Circle Jerks, but you didn't really know that much else about any, you know, mm-hmm, new X. Yeah. But you know, hadn't heard a lot of their stuff.
Well, like X had some radio hits. None of these, yeah, other bands were going to have radio hits.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was your gateway into punk then?
So I started off, I mean, funny thing is I started off getting really into, when I was like 12 or 13, really into New Order and Joy Division. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of work backwards from there, mm-hmm, and you're kind of like, well, what, you know, you discover like, oh, like Joy Division were in a punk band called Warsaw before that. And they all met at a Sex Pistols show. And then you hear about the Sex Pistols, yeah, and the Clash, yeah, and like, so, and then I kind of move forward from there. So it's kind of moved backwards in time, mm-hmm, to like the British stuff, which I loved and I still do. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of move forward from there, and then you discover that there were these little scenes like all over the country. So you know, discover that, like, you know, in LA they had a punk scene, and in, you know, DC they had a scene, in New York they had a scene. I mean, everyone kind of knew the Ramones. I mean, it's kind of hard to not have heard of the Ramones, I think.
Yeah,
they were on like flagship commercial radio at the time.
Yeah, yeah, and like Rock and Roll High School would be on TV sometimes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
MTV always had that.
Yeah, yeah, and MTV, yeah, would play would play I Want to Be Sedated.
Yeah.
Did you have a very conscious like move of like, I'm going to be a punk now? Did you have that moment?
I don't know, because I think that, you know, I'd always, it's funny because like a lot of people get into punk mainly like through metal.
Right.
Like kind of when you're like a junior high, like
Amoebix or something.
Yeah. You'd be into metal, and then you would just discover like something else that was kind of aggressive and tough. Mm-hmm. And, I think I always kind of liked I always liked the music, but I also like the sort of, the fact that it was like dissenting from the mainstream. Like I've had this very strong sense of like, I don't want to be into the same things that like other people are into, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, like kind of carving out that identity for myself when I was like 14 or whatever. And so I think by the time I got to like senior year of high school, I made friends with some kids that were like more into hardcore and started in punk and starting to like turn me on to like other stuff.
Yeah.
And you kind of, you know, kind of take it from there. And when I got to college, I started college in 93, I think. And, and the college radio station I played for, all of a sudden you had this huge library.
Right.
And they'd been collecting punk records since like 79 or something like that. So you'd go back and you'd have all this amazing stuff that you'd never be able to find anywhere else. And like, you'd be able to go and hang out with people who would be like, oh, like you want to learn about like Scottish punk from 82? Like, you know, like here's this pile of records to go listen to.
Yeah.
And it was kind of overwhelming, and it coincided with this kind of resurgence of hardcore in the early to mid 90s, where there was like bands like Born Against coming out of New York and tons of stuff that you know, like were into, like kind of like a lot of like the San
Diego gravity
record stuff. Yeah. And what was great about it is like punk wasn't just this sort of thing that had happened in the past. It was like, oh, like there's a scene happening right now that you can be a part of, and like you can go be in a band and put out records and like put on shows. And I got super, super involved with all that in Boston. Like I started setting up DIY shows and playing in bands and stuff like that.
I would also say like, I don't want to pre-give away too much because we're going to be doing The Punk Singer pretty soon, which is Kathleen Hanna.
Yeah.
Documentary, but for me on that era in the early 90s, like there was like Nirvana was one huge thing that happened that got people kind of interested in punk, and also just Riot Girl was a huge influence, I think, on I'm sure on
Riot
you
Girl
and
was
on
huge
me.
For me.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
as much as it can be for a male,
as dude. Like it's like the like it's still a thing to, I think about like how much, I mean, it was very strange for me because I went to this all boys Catholic high school when I found out about Riot Girl, and it was just like, oh, I guess I should be a feminist, but I'm also in this place where I don't know any women I can like talk to about it. That early 90s period, I think there was a resurgence of an interest in punk, but also kind of morphed into just alternative rock again, like the mainstream kind of absorbing the ideas.
But I think that the there was a real strong DIY ethic as part of it, and it was also easier to draw the lines, I think, between what was
the major label stuff
and the underground stuff at the time.
There's no way to do it now. Yeah. I don't think there's like very little, everything is sponsored content kind of, it feels like.
It's, I mean, it's definitely harder. And I think that, it's also in some respects, I don't want to say it's harder to make a living as a musician, cause I think it's always been really hard. But I do think that given that you can't rely on record sales at all, it's like the idea that if someone wants to come and license your music and put it in their commercial, it's like at the time I would have like, thought that was the worst thing you could do. But now I'm like, I'm not going to begrudge somebody trying to pay their rent.
Yeah. It really is harder, I think. I'm going to say it's harder.
It's weird though when you hear a Ween song on a Toyota commercial, you know, it's like, you're like, what is that all about? But people have to pay bills. And so I'm kind of curious, did you see this? Did you see Decline of Western Civilization in the theater, or did you rent
it? No, it's one of those things you rented.
You could, I didn't think it had theatrical.
I don't know if it had a wide theatrical release.
It might have
all.
Been on the rep houses. Maybe there was a print that they could have circulated that was playing at like a
I remember
rep house.
The Red Vic used to always play it.
They probably were playing a VHS copy, though, is my guess.
Yeah.
They weren't playing a version off of a print.
And so you would rent it?
Yeah, like you'd go over to like somebody's house and they'd have rented. I think I even had a friend who just had like duped it. Copied it.
Yeah.
And
you'd
watch this, you'd watch Suburbia, you'd watch Another State of Mind.
Yeah,
Which is another
the DC one.
And Suburbia is a Penelope Spheres. Yeah.
And that's a fictional narrative film. I don't remember much about it. What do you remember about it? Suburbia? It's after she made this. It's like 82.
It's 84.
84. Okay.
And
late.
So it's about like, because I think she was really fascinated by the kids that were not necessarily. She wasn't. I mean, as much as she kind of focused on like the bands, I think she was most fascinated by the kind of lost kids that came into the scene came from like broken homes or like abusive homes and things like that. And so ended up kind of as street punks.
Yeah. I found that footage really compelling in the first one. And that's what the third Decline is all about, these street punk 90s, like street punk kids.
She says that that's the most important film. Like she thinks that's the one that she would prefer to be remembered for Decline of Western Civilization 3 over anything else she's done.
Oh, wow.
And she made Wayne's World.
Yeah. And Black Sheep.
And Black Sheep.
Which is pretty sweet.
So.
Yeah, Wayne's World is... That's pretty... I've only seen the first one. I can't wait to watch the second one. I listened to her WTF interview
with
Marc Maron.
I gotta listen to that.
It's really good.
Yeah.
She sounds... She's so compelling, and her own life story is amazing.
Yeah. And then a lot of the stuff, the work that was done to bring all this together was really driven by her daughter Anna Fox. And it's fun because like on this DVD commentary track, the first one is her and her daughter talking about it. And they're just, a lot of it is they just see someone on screen that they, like, for the daughter, it's like she knew those people when she was 9 or 10. So it's just like, oh, it's Xene. She's so cute. Oh, she's so young. And like, and then there's like, I'm going to cry. That guy's dead now. And there's a lot of that stuff on there. Like the very first scene, you know, there's that kid with a shaved head named Eugene.
Yeah.
Like in the commentary, they're just like, what happened to Eugene? And then daughter's like, oh, I know what happened. He's like a folk singer.
Yeah, he became
now.
A folk singer.
Yeah. I'm like, but he also dropped an N-bomb pretty early in that movie.
Yes.
So I'm just like, I don't know what kind of folk that is going to be.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's also at the time, it's just like the most shock value stuff they could do was to like bring up Nazism. And
So what was, because, you know, again, I just saw this movie for the first time yesterday. So back in the day, when you first saw it, what was, when people would talk about it, what was the big scene that people would talk about?
I'm not sure there was a, I mean, it definitely talked about the Derby crash stuff. Because he had died. And he died at...
He intentionally OD'd at like 23, 22.
Well, and he got his death, his death got Michael Jackson because John Lennon died the next day.
So
he had this whole idea that he was going to kill himself and become this like rock and roll martyr.
Oh my God.
It was right before December.
It's like the day before.
Oh man.
No. It's like, bad timing.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah.
And had they toured nationally at that point? They had never got out of LA.
He's the lead singer of the Germs.
Yeah.
And so, the kid with the trans lungs.
Right.
I mean, the Germs, it's funny because, you know, to go back to what we're saying about this transition between punk and hardcore, it's like the Germs almost seemed archaic compared with all the other art bands. Because, you know, you think about like Black Flag, I mean, they were kind of professional. But like Greg Ginn was like, took what they were doing really seriously.
Right.
Like they would like go and, like the thing about Black Flag was like, they were obsessive about like promoting and like getting
work ethic.
And like working hard and touring and like building up.
One might say exploitative in some way. Like Greg Ginn is sort of like, has his rep as being this taskmaster.
But we still remember them today. I mean, I mean, I can see their logo and, you know.
Oh yeah, no, SST was like a huge label and hugely influential on so many
bands. But also
like
Black Flag, they would tour around the country and then they would help other bands. They would develop contacts all over the country. And then people would say, hey, I need, you know, I need who do I talk to about getting a show in like Minnesota?
Right.
And they'd be like, oh, this is the guy. And like, so Black Flag did a lot of work.
They built like
creating
that,
a national scene.
Yeah. Mm. Now, did you see American Hardcore? Because I think that covers that stuff more, right?
I went to actually the premiere of that in New York.
And that's like all sort of like 84 to
it
90.
Kinda, a little later.
Yeah.
And I mean, the thing I didn't like about there were definitely, a lot of great bands I got covered in that, but it started to drift into the New York heart, like youth crew stuff, which I was never
I haven't seen the film and I didn't read the book either. It was like less interesting to me, but I have seen Another State of Mind. It's been a very long time since I've seen that one. I feel like that one has more of an arc to it because it's this
tour. It's Social Distortion. No,
are they in it? They visit
Social
them.
Distortion's on tour with.
That's right. Oh, Youth Brigade?
Youth Brigade.
Yeah.
Not the DC Youth Brigade, the other one.
LA.
The LA Youth Brigade. There are two bands named Youth Brigade.
Oops.
Which is confusing.
It is confusing.
There's an Australian X also.
Yeah.
And there's a Dutch the X.
Well, and like you're saying, the Germs seem pretty archaic because I do remember a point in the doc when they want him, Crash Darby, to use the microphone.
Yep.
And
he just won't.
He just doesn't use a microphone.
Yeah. Well, there was just no way. I mean, that kind of super self-destructive, like nihilistic.
Sid Vicious
stuff, style punk. Yeah. Like, by 1980, I'm not saying that there wasn't that. Clearly, like, there are people like that, but I think that you can't be in a band for very long,
right?
Like living like that.
Yeah.
And I think that was, I think that the stuff that I love punk, but I also kind of felt like what attracted me to punk and maybe it was really more hardcore was this idea of like kind of the ethics of it and kind of thinking like trying to be like a thoughtful person thoughtful about like the place you had in the world, the way consumption and like trying to build like a sustainable DIY scene that was outside the mainstream.
Did you get into veganism through punk?
Yeah, I got into, I mean, I was already vegetarian, but I definitely ended up becoming vegan, which I still am. I've been vegan for like 20 years through hardcore. And that was the thing, like in the scene in the 90s became more political, more mindful of like issues around race and gender and animal rights and that sort of thing. And which is very 90s, right? That stuff was before. No one was really, I mean, there were definitely some animal rights stuff in the 80s, but that was really, really on the edge.
Yeah.
But I mean, the Riot Grrrl stuff I felt I really liked in the sense that being like a non-mask, like non-macho dude. Like Riot Girl kind of felt like, okay, because I mean, like the emo screamo stuff was also like the corollary to that, which was right. like you can be like a guy, but also try to be sensitive and like emotional, and yeah. it's okay, mm-hmm. and like not try to be this like aggressive
Henry
like,
Rollins.
Asshole.
You don't have to be yeah. leaving and like calling everyone yeah. a faggot yeah, and yeah. like being abusive towards
that
everyone.
That scene is so funny.
Like they seem so Jersey. He
they
has
do.
Such a Jersey
That's
kind
I
of
thought they were maybe from.
I think like, they're from Philly.
They might be from
I think,
Philly.
I think Leaving yeah. was from Philly, but yeah. the thing about Fear is it almost felt like a Don Rickles kind of thing where
yeah,
he was
like, feel
like,
it
like
was
people would come
roasting.
For that to
it was
be like,
trolling. Yeah. They were trolling.
Like that's what I kind of felt like I almost that's felt funny. Like you would go to see Fear because you with want, the hopes that like maybe you could fight with him on stage.
Yeah,
yeah.
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 He calling people hockey pucks.
Yeah. Almost like those early Black Dice shows where it was all about just antagonizing
yeah,
the audience.
Yeah, yeah.
But so, tell me more about why you like the Germs, because I'm not a big Germs guy, and I having seen this, I'll tell you, I did see this Germs reunion show in 2007.
Yeah.
Basically that oh, What We Do Is Secret movie had come out, and the actor who plays Darby in it ended up doing a bunch of shows where he's fronting the band, and it's Pat Smear, Jeez. Lorna Doom, and Don Bowles
yeah.
backing that guy who plays Darby in the movie.
I remember hearing about that. It seemed really weird.
And
to me.
I kind of liked it. I'm like, oh, this is like, he's a mess, and they're actually pretty tight. So yeah. that's kind of probably what the band would have been like
right.
if Darby had been alive still.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there's just, I think like Lexicon Devil and What We Do Is Secret. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's not like a ton of Germ songs that I think are great, but like there's a handful, but they kind of just like tap into this great, kind of disheveled punk energy, which I really liked. Mm-hmm. I think it's possible to sort of like contradictory things about like, you know, like you can be like, oh, I love like this hardcore song cause it's like yeah. really tight and like, you know, really,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
whatever. And then you can like this sort of shambolic, messy punk mm-hmm. thing.
Right. Or like liking Lil Wayne and like being like, I have problems with it, but yeah. I still recognize there's something at work here that yeah. I don't fully understand. He was like, I mean, his lyrics seemed really interesting, Darby's yeah. lyrics.
I mean, there's definitely a lot of pain, I think, for Darby Crash, right? Mm-hmm. And
yeah, his like brother died of an OD. Is like it's sort of neglected by his mom. Yeah. It seemed like, yeah.
But then you see that interview with him at home, and
he's making eggs.
Yeah, he's making eggs, and then his girlfriend is talking about like kicking that dead body they found in the house. And I'm like, God. What the fuck is wrong with you?
They were so happy, and they took pictures with it.
Yeah, I was yeah. like, that's just a
it's
lot.
It's pretty, yeah, pretty nihilist.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. And so, and I think that was sort of where, you know, as much as I could sort of appreciate that stuff on an aesthetic level, like on a political level, I guess you're yeah. just like, man, like I just never, kind of like the Sex Pistols, right? Where you're like, oh yeah, like I like the Sex Pistols. I think like the music, but like this kind of idea of like pissing people off by wearing a swastika or...
Right,
you
yeah.
know, or fighting with people. I was like, yeah, I'm just not gonna like. Yeah. I can't go there.
There's like, a lot of like, yeah. There's a lot of terms thrown around in decline that are by our today's standards. We'd be like, well, you'd be getting written up on Jezebel right now about
yeah.
this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but I Germs. So you think there's a couple of good songs. The performance in here is pretty much like a crazy mess. But it's like if yeah. you want that, then you're getting it.
But I also think that having been to a lot of punk shows, I guess, over the course of my life, like it wasn't, I mean, if you could actually hear the vocals, like you were lucky. Right?
Yeah.
like that was
That's
not
true.
That was pretty normal.
Does this show have a PA?
Yeah.
No, we just have a guitar amp we're plugging into. Yeah. I'm guilty of that. So
yeah.
many times I've been like, oh, what's a PA?
Yeah.
I have an extra guitar amp. Let's just do that.
Yeah.
They're like, fine. Like I drove 300 miles to do this.
Right. The opposite though is when you got to like hardcore in the mid 90s where like, you have the singer would stop to like read the lyrics or in between
oh,
songs
yeah.
or like
hand
talk
out the sheets
or explain like the politics behind. Like,
oh
this.
No!
And you'd be like, you know what? Like, yeah. I just like you to play some music.
Yeah. yeah. I don't need your flyers.
Did
yeah.
Darby hand out lyric sheets?
I don't know.
I think that's something.
Did you ever get into the Butthole Surfers?
A little bit.
Yeah.
I was never a huge fan of them.
They're interesting because like on one side they go complete psychedelia and then
yeah.
and kind of like Burning Man crash worship kind of direction, and then they could also like a little industrial
yeah.
and then just also just kind of like that Ween direction.
Yeah. They're a weird hybrid band.
Yeah. Right? Like yeah. almost like Primus couldn't exist without the Butthole Surfers.
Right.
If you think about
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So what Paco, since you hadn't seen any of these things, what was your favorite band you liked in the documentary? Musically?
X, I've always been a big fan of X mm-hmm. and I've seen him a few times, but Fear, I thought that was interesting how like, again, like my brother said, he was like the musicality of it, and they just seemed professional in a mm-hmm. kind of unprofessional way, yeah. in a very punk
way.
No,
they were tight. Like, yeah. Like, you were like, wow, like these guys actually like put on a show.
Yeah, yeah. And I just liked the musicality. I liked the fact that people try to get on stage to fight them, and they seem to have a lot of people mm-hmm. throwing people off yeah. the stage.
I bought a Fear album once, and it was like a live one, so maybe that was a mistake, but I didn't really get into it. Yeah, I love that footage of them on Saturday Night Live. That's yeah. like the legendary show. God. Where With actually Belushi. Like Rollins is there, and he's
Ian
like
McKay, I think is in the audience.
Yeah, I think it's like yeah. Rollins like right after that trip is like when he got asked to audition for Black Flag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was Jim Belushi that asked them to be
John,
on.
John, yeah.
John Belushi.
Yeah.
Jim Belushi. Like, hey, I'm hanging up the phone now. I don't know who the fuck you are.
Yeah.
Goodbye. Well, tell me when your brother calls.
He yeah. promised Lorne Michaels that he would do the show. That was the trade-off.
Oh, really? Yeah. For yeah. another season?
Yeah.
If, like, you let my favorite band, Fear, play? What if it was the Germs? That'd be amazing.
And apparently there was this big thing about, because they caused, like, $20,000 worth of damage from that performance.
That.
But
the
then,
camera get knocked
well,
out?
Well, just the scene and stuff. Yeah. But, like, who's the lead singer of Fear?
Lee Ving
was saying that it was more like $500,000. So he was actually trying to.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because it got pricked. That's what the New York Post reported. Yeah. It was the $500,000.
So he was actually putting that in the press. Like, no, we caused like $500,000 worth of damage. And then they asked him, like, well, why would you do that? And he's like, because we're professionals. Yeah. Like, I read that and I was like, I like this guy.
So Lee Ving, I mean, he had an acting career.
Yeah, he's in Clue.
He was on Who's the Boss? He
did,
I didn't know about the yeah. Who's the Boss one. I know about
just,
Clue.
Just one episode.
He's the dead body in Clue.
Oh no way!
Yeah,
he was oh on. Yeah, he God, had like it. He was in a bunch of like minor. No, he had a bunch of minor stuff. Roles.
Murder
like,
She Wrote, probably.
Yeah, he lives in Hollywood. That's yeah, what yeah. happens. You get a day player role. Yeah. And I also like the Alice Bag Band. I thought.
Oh, the Bags. Yeah,
yeah.
I thought
they couldn't call themselves the Bags. They were being sued.
Yeah, by the ex member. Yeah. yeah.
I thought that was cool. I mean, she's wearing fucking heels.
She just put out a book, actually.
Yeah.
There's a memoir that she wrote, and she's still. Pretty active and does a lot of stuff.
I was reading in that oral history. I mean, she was really not happy with the documentary at all.
Okay.
Really?
Well, she felt like that. I mean, she wasn't happy. Well, one, she wasn't happy with their performance, but mm-hmm. she was like, you can't blame Penelope Spheres for that. But right, she yeah. felt like she wasn't interviewed, and she was kind of yeah. like, well, who, you know,
that's true.
You, kind of political about who got interviewed and who didn't. And I think that felt like that it became a little bit of a like an advertisement for Slash Records.
It kind of did feel
because
that
like
way.
The Slash Records bands got the most airtime.
Yeah,
and
what's can you explain the connection?
So wasn't
Slash magazines in there?
Slash magazine became the guy Bob Biggs created Slash Records
he
and
put
they
out
put out
the X album.
They put out X. They put out Germs. Did
they put out the Germs?
I thought they did.
Maybe they did. Yeah.
And they put out one other band on the label. In the documentary.
And Penelope was married.
She was married to him, yes.
Right.
And so there was that, yes. So that was a little bit of a...
I missed that.
Yeah, so she's married to that guy. Yeah. And like,
okay. Are they still married?
No.
No.
They broke. If you listen to the Marc Maron episode, too, she explains how she would go out and about in Hollywood and people would like yell at her that were yeah. in the movie. Like, people didn't like her because of that. Some people didn't like her because of some of the politics behind it, you know.
That would be very much like hardcore.
Yeah.
Be like, yeah. Because like, that's how it would get. Like, if you got like an indie label that got like a little bit above its station in the world, people would be like, man, fuck those guys.
Round for South Street, Philadelphia. I'm from Avenue C. I've seen empty eyes waiting to freeze from the Bowery to. I don't care about you. Fuck you. I don't care about you.
Well, with me, it just comes from like living in this city and just seeing everything, seeing all the ugly old people and just the fucking the buses and just the dirt. That, you know, just that's what I see all the time. So it's just all the time and just fucking bums and just thinking about that. So when I go there, I just sometimes I can get out some aggression maybe by beating up some asshole, you know.
And you're cute.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Well, X was the kind of the most commercially successful of all these bands. Like, they got Ray Manzarek produced their album.
Yeah.
And, like, they were, I think maybe Slash must have, they got licensed to another label because that record was available everywhere.
No, and they ended up, I mean, Los I remember Angeles. Seeing X on MTV and stuff like that.
I remember the Big Black Sun was huge.
Yeah.
Everyone had that t-shirt. I remember.
Yeah, the Bags broke up right before then. Well, yeah, so what are some of the bands you think should have been included? I would say Nervous Gender and the Screamers for sure.
Weirdos, kind of towards the tail end of the Weirdos, but I think if you wanted to kind of show actually that transition between the Anglophile British stuff, because the Weirdos were so much on that. I guess they...
I never was a big Weirdos guy, but where are the Dickies from? Are they from L.A.?
Dickies are from L.A., but I think Dickies were a little later.
A little later,
There was, I guess, is there in the bonus footage some of the footage of the Urinals?
Oh, the Urinals? I don't think they're in here at all. Yeah. No, I don't think they are. But yeah, the Urinals. They did reunions recently. I think. Those are the guys that turned into 100 Flowers.
Yep.
And Screamers. I think has a lot of stuff.
Screamers was great because there was nothing documented. I mean, they never recorded.
Oh well.
And so
it's all bootleg.
It's all bootleg, and they never released anything. So if somebody had been able to document the Screamers in their prime.
What about San Francisco punk bands? Did you ever get into the San Francisco sound?
Well, there's a snippet in the movie where you can hear the Avengers somewhere. Oh, you know what? I'm wrong. There's a snippet in What We Do Is Secret where you can hear the Avengers when they're walking down the hallway. even in the new recent Discord documentary, they throw the Avengers and Dead Kennedys in there. I think those are like the main
ones.
When people think of San Francisco punk, I mean, there's all crime and there's Flipper and all these bands.
What about the Dills?
Yeah, they're considered
Dills were
big.
Part of that. Yeah. Definitely had that Anglophile. Yeah. British style, which were great, except they were pretty pretty political, talking about class war and stuff like that.
Right.
So, but the Avengers, I mean, the Avengers opened for the Sex Pistols at the Sex Pistols last show, the one where did you ever have the feeling you were cheated or whatever that famous line?
Yeah.
So the Avengers opened that show, and apparently it was a complete disaster.
That's 79?
78, but maybe 79.
Yeah.
But again, it was sort of that's when people kind of felt like the energy was kind of coming out of the scene and the destructiveness was taking its toll on people.
Right.
But I mean the SF scene, I mean, Alternative Tentacles was such a big part of what was going on.
But Alternative Tentacles was the record label.
Yeah, it was a record label. Yeah. But it also sort of served as the when they were under attack for censorship trials and things. Like the Frankenchrist trial with H.R. Giger poster there was an obscenity trial about a punk rock band. So I knew about that stuff in junior high school.
Yeah,
so if you had told me back then I'd be working there,
right?
I'd be like, oh, that's pretty weird.
Have you seen the Giger documentary?
I haven't seen that yet.
No.
It's really good.
Is it sort of came out after his death or was
it? Yeah. It's just on Netflix now.
Okay.
Yeah. It's really good.
Yeah. But yeah, so but that speaking of regionalism, I think like hardcore is still I think regionalism still plays. And you're saying how like the internet flattens a lot of things.
Yeah.
When you're dealing with like underground scenes like noise or punk, I think regionalism is still kind of at play, and in comedy too.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's still a regionalism, but I think that I think that one of the things is that it's so much, and I'm not saying this necessarily. I mean, there are things you lose and things you gain, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there was, you kind of have stronger ties or stronger connection to something if the music that you are discover is kind of through the local community and through the people that are around you, rather than being this sort of thing where it's like, well, I got on, went on YouTube and like found this and then found that.
Mm-hmm.
Your passion or connection to it might not be as strong as if you had, kind of come out of the scene.
So. I kind of feel that way now, even like being someone who had a record label, I'm like, it's almost like why I don't know why I would put out a physical product when I could just put it on Bandcamp. I'm starting to feel like that's sort of the, but that's because I don't have as much skin in the game. I'm not involved in the music scene the way I used to be either. But, so takeaway, I would say if you have any passing interest in punk, this is definitely a key document of that era. And specifically also if you just like LA stuff, if you're interested in like LA culture, it's like a weird cross section of LA culture in like 79, 80. Also for me, like I kind of didn't realize, I always think of punk as starting like the tail end of the 70s, but I think the germs started in like 75, 76 or something like that.
That early?
At least according to the what we do, secret document, not documentary, fictional film, which is kind of garbage, by the way. It is very poorly acted, but it's, if you want to see a community theater group dressed as, Ronnie Bingenheimer, the Damned, it's kind of amusing. And I think my friend might have been up to play Don Bowles in it, but he had to go on tour. I'm like, I think you dodged a bullet.
That's funny. So we coming to our conclusion. So Peter, do you like this on a documentary level, or is it like such a historical?
Is it sentimental?
Artifact?
Is it sentimental for you,
I think,
or is it?
I think it's partly sentimental for me, and I think that. So it's hard to say whether it's a great documentary, so to speak. I mean, I definitely have seen people describe it as like the greatest documentary about punk.
Yeah.
And I think that in the sense that it does capture, I mean, it does do a good job of capturing how kind of scary part of that was, right? And how
I was still scared, and I've been involved in punk for so long.
And I think also how
I also don't like spiders,
right?
Yeah, the tarantula stuff.
Yeah, the tarantula stuff. Who is not to interrupt, but who was she talking to when they're in the church? Like that's
Greg Ginn, Ron Reyes, and
that was
Chuck
Black
Dukowski.
Flag. That was Black Flag. Yeah. Okay, and then they're showing
where
they
he lives.
That was great.
I still know people that live like that for sure. We know comedians. Yeah, that live
I like it that like he opens his door to his bedroom and he's like, this is where the magic happens, and he kind of makes a joke and you think this is kind of cute, and then he like the camera pans up and he's like, and that's where this guy lives, and
Dukowski lives like Harry Potter.
It's this little cubby hole. And they're also talking about how they have to like kind of live with the hippies in that. And he's like, they're cool, they just smoke weed and they just talk about their problems.
Yeah, I think like hippie as like a thing that you could describe as
the anti thing.
But also as like a thing that was still around, like living.
Right. Yeah, that's
like
what...
now if I called you a hippie, you'd be like, ha ha ha.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah.
You listen to Blues Traveler or whatever.
Right.
But like,
or you're like just like into like used wood.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you were like called someone a hippie in like 79,
it was
like,
a real hippie.
Yeah, it was like they were a real hippie and like they just were like had just stuck around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I got from that too. Well, we talked about the Source family in a previous episode.
Yeah, yeah.
And I kind of felt
about that one?
No, but it's
it was like a cult that happened on Sunset Boulevard in LA. But like when he met some reason when he said, oh, the hippies, and immediately I got this flash of
cult. Father Yod.
Yeah, that guy.
I think it's sentimental for me too. And it seems clearly like it is almost like a sentimental project for Penelope Spheeris and her daughter. Yeah. Like almost like this is like a big bonding thing for them to get it out there. But that's interesting. I've watched three. I've never watched three. I've watched two before.
but three, if that's the one she feels the most connected to.
Wow.
It seems also like the darkest and saddest one.
Yeah.
But that's
yeah.
also kind of more the era of punk where you and I would have been around, but I was not that into that Naked Aggression or Final Conflict.
Yeah, it was like a side of punk that I did not have any interest in.
Yeah.
And why is that? What's the difference?
There was a Berkeley kids around. Like, this is one of the reasons I didn't get into Crass for so long is because I associated with all these like Berkeley like Telegraph kids.
Yeah, but the Naked Aggression stuff, there was a sort of, I don't know, how would you even describe it? It was like,
musically, just, it's not that good.
Musically, it wasn't very interesting. It was just a sort of like punk.
There's a female singer.
That was Naked Aggression?
I thought so.
But like the it was this kind of, it was just like punk, but as if like you, it had become sort of fossilized, right, in terms of like stylistically. Whereas I think the stuff that like George and I were into in the mid 90s, like early whatever to
yeah,
late 90s,
late 90s,
like
yeah.
a lot of that stuff was musically kind of challenging and they were pushing things in a new direction and kind of sonically interesting combined with the political stuff. Mm-hmm. I think it's also frankly that there's a difference between what kind of punk and hardcore you were into in the 90s as like a middle class kid versus a working class.
Oh,
like
interesting.
That's interesting.
So class.
True.
There was like definitely a class element.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
But there was that with Riot. I mean, Riot Girl was a middle class phenomenon, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't.
Suburban middle class.
Yeah. And yeah. I think, and that was.
Like the college rock aspect of it was like taken out if you were just like a poor kid who just got into like street punk or something like that, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was definitely when I was in Boston, like that. There were definitely kind of like crusty punk kids who were came from like shitty homes,
yeah,
or
really
like
shitty
lived
place.
On the street, right. or whatever, in squats,
yeah.
and
yeah,
and,
yeah,
and they, but all those kids were really into the Subhumans,
yeah, yeah,
like really into the Subhumans, like that was the band,
yeah,
or like
the UK's, yeah.
the UK like kind of Crass Records anarchist stuff,
yeah,
and I was friends with like you know those kids too, like I would set up shows and we'd have some of the you know bands that appealed to those guys too, and mm-hmm. I liked the Subhumans and I like Crass and like Flux of Pink Indians and that kind of mm-hmm. music too, but it was definitely, you could definitely see this sort of you know class divide that
right
emerged.
Yeah, it was like this idea that like we could like graduate out of something maybe, or maybe that's not the right terminology, but like yeah, that like we needed music for slightly different reasons, possibly. I don't know.
Well, and it's also, I think it was about what kind of social capital you had around what you could create and, mm-hmm. and what you, you know.
Who's the most successful punk band, like album wise?
Are you talking like
Green
yeah.
Day?
Oh,
that's a good
Green
point.
Day.
Yeah, I think you're right. Do you think they would be more?
Oh
well,
yeah, they're pretty big.
I just
Nirvana?
Think they sold. I don't wouldn't call Nirvana a punk band.
They were
band.
Not yeah. a punk band. They were definitely of a punk.
They came out of punk, but
yeah, like,
but I would say that Green Day probably. I mean, look, if yeah. you had a Broadway musical, yeah.
right?
I mean, or the Clash or the Sex Pistols, but in terms of like the U.S.
financially,
yeah,
probably
yeah
Green
that
Day,
makes
yeah.
sense.
That makes sense.
I just saw a video of them playing at their high school. Have you seen? It's on
Green Day.
Yeah, Green Day.
Oh yeah, when they were like were living up in like Eureka or whatever. Yeah,
yeah, they're playing some yeah. high school.
I haven't seen that footage, but I saw them pretty. I you saw them after really. Dookie, though. I saw them after they'd already signed and everything. But yeah, so let's talk about how we end this.
Well,
how edit that, Will.
Yeah, this is how we end it. We end by asking our guests to either recommend a documentary or tell us what's the documentary that got you into watching documentaries.
Well, I don't think I can recall the documentary that got me into documentaries because that would have been a long mm-hmm. time ago. Probably something that my parents rented.
Right.
Actually, I think that if you like Decline of Western Civilization, I think Another State of Mind is worth watching because it is a few years later mm-hmm. and it also, you get to see Minor Threat and you get to see them sort of touring around and there's more of a like a narrative arc.
But you have to see Social Distortion, so that's a downside of
well,
it.
Well, that is true. that is true.
Kind of the, like at that time they're okay, but later Social Distortion
yeah.
by
later
the 90s
you,
is garbage.
But it's also, I think Another State of Mind is less about the music and more about the
it's like brotherhood and
interpersonal.
Like
yeah, and you get to see actually some of the DIY stuff. Like there's that guy who's complaining about the, there is, because I know Antioch Arrow samples it.
Oh, yeah, like $5 show.
The Cramps come through here and they play it at the 21 plus show, and you know, like, fuck them. Like, you know, Social yeah. Distortion comes through and they play an all ages show, like, for the kids, and you know,
yeah,
like that
yeah.
kind of stuff.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so I think that was when.
It's not about the money.
Yeah, not about the green or whatever. But I think that's when. I think that what happened is that, especially as New Wave, and there were punk bands that kind of graduated into being like really well-established and sort of broadened their sound or made it more appealing to the mainstream.
Yeah, like maybe X was one of those.
X was right. one of those, yeah. But I think they're like
other country rock.
The other example, I mean, Billy Idol and
things like that. Generation.
And so, and I think what happened was like you had people that say, well, we have to like not just be in opposition to that, but we actually have to sort of like ostracize people from the community either aspire to that or attain any of that level of success. And so, I mean, I remember like when I was, you know, a DJ in college, like we were like, we will not play any record from a major label. Mm-hmm. And then we were like, well, we're not going to play any label. We're going to play any record that has a barcode on it.
Yeah.
And,
nice.
And in retrospect, that seems like a little fucked up.
It's a little, yeah.
But it definitely made it really easy. And I remember like, because I set up shows, people would call me up. And I'm really embarrassed about this, but this one guy called me up from his band. And I should have just said, like, sorry, I'm just like busy and I can't, I'm not.
But you were like, no.
I was like, no, because I heard that you guys put out one of your 7-inches through like this label, which has like a major label distribution deal.
Yeah.
Like one.
And he was just like,
inch.
Okay. And then he called me back. He's like, I'm fucking angry at you. And I was like, all right, dude. Like,
sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm still not going to do a show for you. But mainly, I mean, his band was terrible.
Oh, that reminds me of like when I tried to book a band at ABC in El Rio and they're like, sorry, we only book punk bands. And I got all like pissy about it.
Yeah.
But I'm like, in the end, it was fair. It's their call, whatever. It's their club. They can do what they want.
But that's why, I mean, that's when, I mean, we didn't talk about Maximum Rock and Roll really at all, but like when Maximum Rock and Roll started to really codify the sound, that's when all these splinter, like Punk Planet came out and Heart Attack and some of the other like big zines that were like,
in reaction to that,
we're going to not define it. We're going to define it by your, it's funny that I say, we're going to define it by your politics and your practices, not by your sound, which ended up sort of also,
that's creating,
you know, then it's like, okay.
Well, that's not like Punk Planet had Nick Cave on their cover, but like Heart Attack would just stay like all these sub level.
Yeah, and Heart Attack was definitely more ideologically pure, but then it's kind of like you end up with like a world in which like Jawbreaker doesn't get covered in any of these magazines, zines, because like they still sound pretty punk, but they're on a major label.
Yeah.
That's how they ended up kind of ruining their career, I guess.
But they now have like a huge legacy with young kids that weren't around in the first time.
They should do a reunion tour and just cash in on it.
Yeah, well, that's another episode. Yeah. We'll have to do with Adam.
Speaking of ruining your career, thanks for being on our podcast, Peter.
Your MVP.
Wait, this isn't going to go out, right? This is just fun, right?
All your MVP people.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find episodes of SupDoc on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please review, subscribe, and rate.
And you can follow us on Twitter at SupDocPodcast and online at SupDocPodcast.com.
This show is produced by Will Scovel, and our theme music is by David Siegel.
If you want to suggest a documentary or a future guest, please email us at SupDocPodcast@gmail.com.